today?
HPPodcraft.com
is successfully probing deep into the mysteries of the universe, the greatest mystery of all, time itself. Time itself.
In another moment, we were standing face to face, I and this fragile thing out of futurity. He came straight up to me and laughed into my eyes. The absence from his bearing of any sign of fear struck me at once. Then he turned to the two others who were following him and spoke to them in a strange and very sweet and liquid tongue. There were others coming, and presently a little group of perhaps 8 or 10 of these exquisite creatures were about me. One of them addressed me. It came into my head, oddly enough, that my voice was too harsh and deep for them. So I shook my head and, pointing to my ears, shook it again. He came a step forward, hesitated, and then touched my hand. Then I felt other soft little tentacles upon my back and shoulders. They wanted to make sure I was real. There was nothing in this at all alarming. Indeed, there was something in these pretty little people that inspired confidence, a graceful gentleness, a certain childlike ease. And besides, they looked so frail that I could fancy myself flinging the whole dozen of them about like ninepins.
Did the time traveler stumble onto a Pfeiffer family reunion?
No, that's a different book. That's the Slime Machine.
What?
I don't know. It was either that or I was going to say the Time Latrine. That was another one I thought of, but those are pretty insulting to my family members who are actually really delightful people.
Yeah.
I certainly don't think you're going to be knocking me or any of them around like ninepins, though. We are a casserole-eating people. unlike these little fruit-eating baby people. What are we actually reading?
Oh, we are reading The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, and that was the first part of the fourth chapter. June, of course, is for The Time Machine.
Yes.
All Time Machine, all June.
I actually traveled ahead a few weeks and listened to all these time travel shows. And you did. They're all really great, yeah.
Oh,
except
wonderful.
In the fourth one, you go on this really long sexist rant.
What?
Pretty unsettling stuff, but now I just know not to mention female train engineers, and we'll head that one off, so what? I won't bring it up. So who was that limey reading at the top? See, Chris, if you traveled ahead like I did, you could have stopped me from saying that. Who was that English gentleman reading?
That reader is a fan favorite, Greg Johnson.
Yes.
Just in case you hadn't heard yet, Greg and I did a Lovecraftian comedy horror audio play called Quiet and Bold. You all need to go and listen to it. The second episode should be out this month, but right now, if you want to hear it, go to quietandbold.com.
That drama also features Heather Klinke and Rachel Lackey.
Yes.
I like to call them the Cursed Wives Club. Everybody should check it out. And folks, they'll also be joining us at Necronomicon this year.
Yeah.
And Rachel. The exact time of the show that we're going to do, the live show there, will be determined soon. We don't quite know it yet, but
yes.
If you want to pick up tickets, you can still donate to get on the list for that show at hppodcraft.com.
Just a quick recap, our main character, known only as the Time Traveler, or we've been calling him Herb, was hanging out with his Victorian buddies, bragging about a time machine he had built. He disappears for a week and shows up late to his own dinner party. And you should never be late to your own dinner party, especially if you're a time traveler. He's got no excuse.
I know, he did it for dramatic effect, I think. Because he could have shown up right on time. Probably did it to make Philby mad, you know, the argumentative person with red hair. He's been sticking in everybody's craw. Philby was actually at the first dinner party, and I don't know if he's been invited to this one. Yes, I was! All right. Philby's there.
When Herb shows up, he's all messed up, and he starts telling his story. He has gone to the far future, and it is some strange world where these pretty little frail people have shown up and seem to be nice.
Yeah.
They start pawing over his time machine, so he yells at them, and then he unscrews his handles, and those are the little levers that he pushes forward or backwards to travel forward or back in time.
Right.
So when he unscrews them, they can't mess with his time machine and, you know, accidentally travel in time.
I mean, I'm all for things being user-friendly. I love good intuitive design, but when you've created a machine that
yeah.
somebody could use to erase you from existence, maybe make it a little more complicated? You know, unscrewing the levers is a pretty good safety, but if they were not unscrewed, then anybody could have just taken off with the time machine.
Yeah, right.
Like a Jack the Ripper type, say.
Or Jack the Ripper specifically, yeah.
You should at least have to punch in a code or something before you use the time machine. That's what I think. But these creatures who greet him get a description. It says their hair, which was uniformly curly, came to a sharp end at the neck and cheek. There was not the faintest suggestion of it on the face, and their ears were singularly minute. The mouths were small, with bright red, rather thin lips, and the little chins ran to a point. I kind of imagine them like little anime people, like I said last week.
As they made no effort to communicate with me, but simply stood round me, smiling and speaking in soft, cooing notes to each other, I began the conversation. I pointed to the time machine and to myself. Then, hesitating for a moment how to express time, I pointed to the sun. At once, a quaintly pretty little figure in checked purple and white followed my gesture, and then astonished me by imitating the sound of thunder. So, as he's talking to these little people, he realizes that they're not actually very smart.
Right.
He says that the year is 802,000.
Wow.
And he thought humans would be super smart, but they aren't.
I mean, they think he came out of like a thunderstorm or something like
that. Yeah, exactly. To put things in perspective, the first Homo sapiens, modern humans, our direct ancestors, have been discovered to be about 200,000 years old. I don't personally think humans will be recognizable in 100 years, let alone in 800,000 years.
No way. Why did he go so far? I mean, you're kind of guaranteed to be confused.
Yeah.
Without actually experiencing the change as it's happening, even 50 years would be jarring, especially with the exponential nature of change in human history. I mean, it just
right.
speeds up. Back to the smooth little Kate Moss people.
One puts a chain of flowers around Herb's neck, and they applaud. They love it. So they lead him to the nearest building. And the buildings and the gardens are beautifully kept, but they're very old and worn.
Kind of looks like Phoenician ruins. This whole future world is sort of shabby chic.
The gardens are overgrown, but there are no weeds. There are some of these little people in the building as they guide him in, and they all seem pretty happy to see him. There are a bunch of tables and cushions and little people just chilling. And they offer him some food, and he accepts. The place, though beautiful, like I said, is really run down. The lovely curtains are covered in dust. Many of the stained glass windows are broken. These people are vegetarians, he says, and that all the food animals are extinct in this future. So there's no sheep or cattle, dogs, anything like that. The fruit is strange, but delicious.
Yeah, he doesn't recognize a lot of it, but he does enjoy eating it. And I mean, he thinks that animal life is all extinct.
Right.
He's drawing conclusions. This is a pretty small set of people to draw any conclusions about the world at large.
Yeah.
They're just the first people he met. I mean, you were making a joke at the top, but if you were to land, say, in a park somewhere in central Illinois, and boom, the Pfeiffer family reunion was the first group that brought you in, you would make all sorts of crazy assumptions about the world based on that.
Yeah.
Gathering, you know. Mm-hmm. In this future time, there are a few vegetables left, and those that survive grow a thick skin of cheese for protection.
The people don't speak English. He holds up one of his strange fruits, and he gets them to say what it's called. He's able to get to eat out of them before they get bored with it, and they just kind of wander away. So he figures he's got to take it slow. He says he never met a more indolent or easily fatigued people.
Total ADD rampant.
The little people get bored with Herb easily. They'll be into him for a bit, but then they'll just wander away. He goes outside, and he looks at how the landscape has changed, because remember, he's still in London.
Yes.
The big building I left was situated on the slope of a broad river, but the Thames shifted perhaps a mile from its present position. 800,000 years, there has been geographical changes. They're not
right.
great, but still noticeably different. He says, the world has changed. It's as if there was a great civilization, but something happened and nature was slowly taking it back. And he notices that there are no individual houses and that they all live in big structures together. And he says to himself, communism. He's looking around. He notices a bunch of these little people are following him. Looking at them, he really sees that they are very feminine, and the males are hard to separate from the female. And the children look just like smaller versions of the adults.
Seeing the ease and security in which these people were living, I felt that this close resemblance of the sexes was, after all, what one would expect. For the strength of a man and the softness of a woman, the institution of the family, and the differentiation of occupations are mere militant necessities of an age of physical force. Where population is balanced and abundant, much childbearing becomes an evil rather than a blessing to the state. Where violence comes but rarely and offspring are secure, there is less necessity, indeed there is no necessity, for an efficient family, and the specialization of the sexes with reference to their children's needs disappears. We see some beginnings of this even in our own time, and in this future age, it was complete. This, I must remind you, was my speculation at the time. Later, I was to appreciate how far it fell short of the reality.
We're getting some of the sci-fi goods here now.
Yeah.
Looking at a future that reflects what the author thinks might happen to humanity. It's so hard to know what the future is going to be because things change in ways we can never anticipate. And I still think about how you said a few weeks ago, if you look at the population trends of Toronto, since it's growing, that can only show that everyone will eventually live in Toronto.
Right. Extrapolating current trends is a really poor way to predict the future. Sometimes it's accurate, but mostly it's not.
But Wells was Victorian, and what he sees within his society, the good and the bad, are shown in the story. He's seen how the Industrial Revolution is changing the world, and his ideas of where it's going are sort of what this book is really about, I think.
It's where the social commentary starts, and it's less of an adventure story.
Yeah.
I think this, it's not even commentary, though, you know, it's just a little bit of guesswork, and I think this text is still applicable to trends we see today. I mean, I think some of these ideas are relevant in our current culture, and this book should still be widely taught because it starts some really interesting conversations about the future, obviously.
Yeah.
And there are the larger political ideas like communism that come in and out of popular consciousness, but also this idea of gender fluidity in the future.
Yes.
In these people, that their sexuality and their gender is kind of hard to peg, and they're all a little more similar. And that's something that's happening now and causing generational strife. You know, young people are much more flexible in their gender identities and sexuality, and it's pretty confounding to older generations that are used to more clear demarcations and rules.
Yeah.
And I paused while I was reading this, which is, you know, and I just sort of thought about a lot of things, which is what great science fiction does.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, yeah, you know, the great hope is that some of these things that divide us now will disappear as we become a more tolerant society. I mean, still all the time when I read scripts, I'll see the character breakdowns and it's like, this guy's a hacker. This guy's tortured by memories of his childhood abuse. And this guy's gay. Like, what? That's his character description? You know, the first two hetero guys, it was all about what they actually do. But that's his.
Yeah.
Also, there's a woman. She wears glasses, so we know she's smart. But underneath, she's thinking about sex all the time.
Wait, is this your script, Pfeiffer?
Yeah, that's all scripts. But sometimes people express a wish, I've heard, you know, that racial mixing will become so prevalent that racial distinctions will start to disappear. Mm-hmm. Everybody will be white and black and Asian, and we'll all just sort of be one blended race, which, you know, I think that's a great utopian idea, but I do suspect that it'd take even more than 800,000 years to stamp out tribalism. You know, even when we're all blended into one race of gender fluid people, people will still be like, well, we're all the same, but those people in District C, they're bad at eating fruit. We're better at eating fruit than they are. I just don't think those things will ever leave.
Dude, tribalism has nothing to do with, well, I mean, it can be obviously assigned to race or nationality or even what state you're in or what sports team you like. It doesn't matter what it, people will always find something to dislike other people for. Hopefully that changes one day, but I don't think that will change before humans actually become something other than human.
Exactly. Right. Until the singularity happens.
If that happens. And of course, there could be some existential threat and we all die. So who knows?
On that cheery note, let's jump back into our story.
So Herb goes off on his own and just has a think while watching the sunset. And he notices that there were no hedges, no signs of property rights, no evidence of agriculture, that the whole earth just became a garden. Herb thinks what he's found is humanity on the wane. It's fading away, dying out. He thinks of how much agriculture changed the world to support humanity, but now agriculture is gone. Nature is going back to its more natural state. But this place has nature helping the humans. It says the air was free from gnats. The earth was free from weeds or fungi. Everywhere were fruits and sweet and delightful flowers. Brilliant butterflies flew hither and thither. The ideal of preventative medicine was attained. Diseases had been stamped out. I saw no evidence of any contagious diseases during all my stay. I still have to tell you later that even the process of putrefaction and decay had been profoundly affected by these changes. Putrefaction and decay are different? So, like, there has been a biomolecular change to life?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they've perfected preservation sciences on some genetic level. So it continues without maintenance. Food doesn't decay and putrefy, and neither do they. I mean, they must be like, they lather you up with some sunscreen when you're born, and then you're good for 80 years.
Right.
Some future thing like that. And there probably were some dark ages where they hit you with a bunch of body spray too, but thankfully those foolish customs have passed out of fashion by this point. Give that baby the axe. But everything is set up for them by the environment, so there's very little for them to know about or do or worry about.
There's no war. There's no conflict of any kind. You know, like you were suggesting that they didn't like the others in Section C. Not the case.
Doesn't seem to be that way.
Section C's fine.
Yeah,
Section B's fine. D's fine. Everybody's fine.
Everybody's cool.
But he thinks about this, and his idea is that hardships caused us to innovate, to invent, and to think. Challenges make us better, but these creatures have no challenges, so they've become weak mentally and physically. The society most likely got rid of war and labor, so humans became artisans. This is him piecing things together. He doesn't know this for sure. It says, no doubt the exquisite beauty of the buildings I saw was the outcome of the last surging of the now purposeless energy of mankind before it settled down into perfect harmony with the conditions under which it lived. The flourish of the triumph which began the last great peace. This has ever been the fate of energy and security. It takes the art into eroticism, and then come languor and decay. This whole idea that society became perfect, that there was no labor anymore, there was no war, people can just be artisans.
And artists, you know? I mean, he says it takes the art into eroticism, so I think that once labor's been eliminated and we have everything that we need, then people start doing what the Lovecraftian idea was, right? We don't have to work, so we can just all try to make beautiful things.
Right.
Or we can try and have amazing sex.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually these things become boring in and of themselves, and then we just have a sort of decadence.
Well, it's just not even a decadence, it's just that people don't do anything. They kind of it's like, well, I'm going to work on this art project. Instead of spending 40 hours a week on their art project, they spend maybe 2 hours a week on their art project.
Or they don't have to do it.
They don't have to do it. And then they just kind of lay around and eat and have sex and lay in the sun and, you know, and that's it.
The time traveler, you know, he's got it all figured out that this is what happened. And he says, very simple was my explanation and plausible enough, as most wrong theories are. And that concludes the chapter. And Philby says, you're not wrong.
God, <he's... laughs>
I say you're right.
He has to argue.
Just with everything.
Even when he's on your side, he's arguing with you.
It's exhausting. But what a great chapter. There's so many things to think about. And Wells distills everything into very simple kinetic sentences. None of them are wasted. Each thought in each paragraph is a world of ideas. He makes all these suppositions in this last chapter about what's going on. He's well aware that he's also writing a little bit of a mystery for us, because there's more beneath this veneer than he's seeing that is slowly going to be revealed. And the first part of that happens in this next chapter, chapter 5.
As night descends, he goes down to find some place to sleep. And when he returns to the Sphinx, which is where his time machine was parked, it's gone.
Yes. At once, like a lash across the face, came the possibility of losing my own age, of being left helpless in this strange new world. The bare thought of it was an actual physical sensation. I could feel it grip me at the throat and stop my breathing. Just great visceral writing there.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what he's talking about. That panic, that blind panic that you have. It's, for me, it's like if I'm out with the kids and then I lose one of them. Like, where are they? Where's my kid? What happened? And then you go, oh, he's standing right behind me.
But in that moment, your brain time travels on 30 different threads of what possibly could be next. And you have like a panic attack, you know, because all those possibilities are so frightening. And that's the moment he finds himself in here.
Yeah, so he freaks out. He can't find it anywhere, and he thinks maybe the little people moved it. So he looks around frantically where they live and inside their places, but he still finds nothing.
But, well, except for a cigarette butt, still smoldering. He lifts it and he smells. Wait a minute, this is the brand Jack the Ripper smokes. Egad! No, that doesn't happen.
That does not happen. Herb still has his...
Swisher Sweets, by the way. That's what Jack smokes.
Herb still has his levers, so he knows that they didn't run off in time, so they must have moved the time machine in space.
Right.
He goes into one of their great halls and he grabs the little people by the shoulders and he starts yelling at them, you know, where's my time machine? Some of them laugh because they just don't know what's going on, and it's just funny behavior, but some of them actually get scared. I do not remember all I did as the moon crept up in the sky. I suppose it was the unexpected nature of my loss that maddened me.
Yeah, that line, I do not remember all I did. I think you got a little weird with these people.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, what?
I don't remember all I did. Maybe I tied some up to a chair and had them pull me around like a Roman emperor. I don't know. Something like that, maybe. So after some running around like a madman and scaring all the little people, he is overcome with misery and he just kind of falls asleep.
There's some great Lovecraftian writing in those passages. He says, I have a memory of looking in this impossible place and that of groping among moonlit ruins and touching strange creatures in the black shadows.
In the morning, he wakes up to a lovely day and he thinks about being stuck here and that actually could be pretty interesting.
Yeah, maybe things aren't as bad as his panic attack led him to believe.
He tries to ask the little people again, but they don't understand him and don't really seem interested at all in what he's talking about, what's going on. So Herb then looks at where the time machine was, and he sees that in the grass there are little marks, weird sloth-like footprints and dragging marks that go to the bronze pedestal where the Sphinx is. He notices there are little removable panels, but there are no handles or keyholes, so he isn't sure how they would open, but they seem like they could open. Two of the little people show up and they look really concerned when he's poking around by this Sphinx, and he signs that he wants to open the thing. And he says, I don't know how to convey their expression to you. Suppose you were to use a grossly improper gesture to a delicate-minded woman. It is how she would look.
I have a feeling that Wells knows that look all too well.
Oh, Herb. Herb hassles some more of them, and he gets the same reaction, and then he just kind of gives up on these little people. They're not going to really help him out. So he bangs on the bronze pedestal door thing, and Herb thinks that he hears a chuckle from inside. Herb goes off to have a look around, going up the side of the valley. He comes across these wells. These open wells have bronze rims, and they're protected from the rain. In them, he hears what sounds like a rhythmic beating of an engine, like a thud, thud, thud. And he takes out a piece of paper and he drops it in, but instead of it fluttering down, it sucked in. Mm-hmm. And Herb thinks that maybe this is some kind of ventilation system or a sewer of some kind. Herb wonders if it has something to do with the dead little people, because he's seen no cemeteries and none of them are sick or old. And he also thinks about how there are no machines. Where do these people get their clothes from? You know, they're obviously like complicated cloth fabrics. So they're made by some kind of textile somewhere. So who's making them?
I've kind of had this similar feeling when I've been out, you know, in Los Angeles sometimes, where you'll be like, where are all these? There are all these beautiful people who are young and they're hanging out in the middle of a weekday. Where's their money coming from? What do they do for a living? How are they able to do this?
It's Morlocks. That's what it is.
I think so.
That day, Herb also decides to be a creep. He says, I made a friend of a sort. It happened that as I was watching some of the little people bathing in a shallow. Mm-hmm. So he's perving on them. They're naked and doing a little swim, and he's just watching them. I guess they're libertine types, these little people. You know, they don't really seem to have much of a shame or any of these things. So I guess Herb's thinking, when in Rome.
I guess so. He tries to downplay all of his creep behavior. Like in that little sentence he wrote, it just happened that I was watching some of them bathe. It wasn't something he decided to do. You know?
Whoops. Oh, my. I think I'll just happen to sit here accidentally. Yeah. For the next half hour. Anyway, one of these little people bathing gets a cramp or something and is pulled into the flow. Herb jumps in and saves her.
And they're so weak that it's not even a strong current, but she just is helpless and they don't do anything to help her.
Yeah.
So he jumps in, but it says, one started drowning, so I hurriedly slipped off my clothes and rescued her. It's like, wait, Herb, was that necessary? Like, maybe he's been doing this the whole time he's there. Like, I saw that one of them had tripped and fallen, so I hurriedly slipped off my clothes and helped her up. Another time, one of them was choking, so I hurriedly slipped off my clothes and delivered the Heimlich maneuver. He's like, that's how Herb helps everybody.
Well, you know, when in Rome. He gets her awake and then leaves her. You know, just like, make sure she's okay. But he doesn't have any relationship with her, so he just, once she's okay, he, you know, gives her a nod and walks off. He figures these folks don't really do gratitude. It's not a thing in their culture, so yeah. He doesn't really expect anything in return.
Well, they have such short attention spans. There's no way she's going to remember, which makes it so much easier to slip off of your clothes.
Yeah. Oh, golly. But later on, she shows up, and she gives him a bunch of flowers. And they sit together, and she kisses his hands. And they pass each other flowers. He tries to talk to her, but they never really say more than a few words in a sentence. But he gets her name, and it's Weena, which in the other draft we find out was her last name. And her first and middle names were Oscar and Meyer.
Oh, man.
Sorry, that's terrible.
Wait, hold on. I got it. Where's my trombone sound?
They become friends, or at least that's what he calls it, for a week. And she's super into him, and she follows him around, gets upset when he leaves, and he says that she behaves much like a child would. He realizes that they still have fear through Weena. During the day, everything's fine, but at night, she gets really anxious. And he actually gets into her, and he ends up sleeping with her for a few nights of the week. And not sure if when he says he slept with her, if it's in quotes or not.
Hard to know.
You know, like, was he sleeping with her or is he just sleeping with her?
It's up for the reader to decide.
In the middle of the night, he gets up to wee or something. It doesn't say. But he looks outside and he says that he sees ghost. Three several times, as I scanned the slope, I saw white figures. Twice, I fancied I saw a solitary white ape-like creature running rather quickly up the hill. And once near the ruins, I saw a leash of them carrying some dark body. And then he looks at his bottle of whiskey and shakes his head and he throws it over his shoulder. No, that didn't happen. In the morning, the things he saw are gone. No sign of the white creatures. On his fourth day there, it gets really hot.
He comments a few times that it's much hotter in this future.
And Herb is looking for some shelter from the sun and the heat. In an old ruined building, he sees that there are some eyes looking out at him from the darkness. He gets scared at first, ready for a fight. But then he remembers how safe this place is and tries to talk to the thing. It runs out past him, the small ape thing. It says, "My impression of it, of course, imperfect, but I know it was a dull white and had strange large grayish red eyes. Also that there was flaxen hair on its head and down its back." It runs and then crawls down the wall like a spider and into a shaft that has a little metal footholds and handrests to climb down. Herb lights a match, which burns out, then he lights another, trying to get a look down the shaft and at the thing. As he stares down the hole, he realizes that there are two types of creatures on this earth. One's above and one's below.
And the ones that are below, they're, he calls them bleached, obscene, nocturnal things.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they're living down there. They're almost like those creatures from The Descent or something. You know, they don't see the light, so their eyes are huge and they're pale and
right.
Disgusting.
He asks, of course, what do they do for one another? How do they coexist? Some of the little people come by throwing flowers at each other. You know, like just, that's yeah. What they do.
It's Friday night.
As he tries to ask them about the white ape people, they are just kind of scared of him and the fact that he's at this well. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to Weena and he asks her, but she's just useless. She doesn't really help. He says, again, the exclusive tendency of richer people due no doubt to their increasing refinement of their education and the widening gulf between them and the rude violence of the poor is already leading to the closing in their interest of considerable portions of the surface of the land. So again, he's, you know, thinking about Victorian society and how the wealthy aren't really doing much of anything. And the lower classes are actually doing everything.
Right. He thinks this is the 1% up here. And then all the lower classes are down there making their clothes, doing their bidding. And it's a reasonable supposition.
Right. He decides at this point to finally name these things. The people above are called the Eloi, and the people below he's dubbed the Morlocks.
Then came troublesome doubts. Why had the Morlocks taken my time machine? For I felt sure it was they who had taken it. Why, too, if the Eloi were masters, could they not restore the machine to me? And why were they so terribly afraid of the dark? I proceeded, as I have said, to question Weena about this underworld, but here again I was disappointed. At first she would not understand my questions, and presently she refused to answer them. She shivered as though the topic was unendurable, and when I pressed her, perhaps a little harshly, she burst into tears. They were the only tears, except my own, I ever saw in that golden age. When I saw them, I ceased abruptly to trouble about the Morlocks and was only concerned in banishing these signs of the human inheritance from Weena's eyes. And very soon she was smiling and clapping her hands while I solemnly burned a match.
Well, he doesn't know what's going on. It brings up a lot of good questions. I think in our next episode we're going to find out what the actual deal is with the Morlocks and the Eloi.
We're going to find out a lot about these guys. I am loving this book. I love it so much.
It's the best. Such a fun thing to read. Such a fun thing to think about. And I'm excited we're doing another couple weeks of it.
Yeah, me too. I want to thank Greg Johnson for reading like a mofo.
Mm-hmm.
Kicking ass and taking names, being fantastic. And if you want to hear him be fantastic on something else, you should check out Quiet and Bold at quietandbold.com.
Don't waste time. Do it now. Check it out. That's all we've got for this week. I've been and am Chad Pfeiffer.
I am Chris Lackey.
No, you're not. And this has been the H.P. Lovecraft
Philby
Literary Podcast. I'm Philby. I've got red hair. HPPodcraft.com or whatever.
HPPodcraft.com.